It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. With no statewide stay-at-home order in place, counties and local governments are coming up with their own safeguards against COVID-19. We heard from Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes last week. We'll hear from a Republican state lawmaker coming up. First, live music is largely on hold right now as most music venues are closed down and artists have put their tours on hold. Some musicians have been live streaming performances over the internet, but for those of us missing the energy of a concert with a crowd, it's a good time to listen to some of our favorite live albums. Our next guest says he wasn't always a fan of live recordings, but these days he is seeing the appeal and he's here to share some of his favorites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite live album or concert video? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Justin Barney is the music director at 88.9 Radio in Milwaukee. Justin, good to have you back on Central Time.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote that you weren't always a fan of live albums, but you've been coming around. What changed your mind on live recordings?
Yeah, you know, I think that I just, you know, I had a clever opinion. I think that we do this thing in music sometimes where it's like, you know, there is an ideal version of this song. Why would I listen to the live version when they made the perfect version in the studio? The live version is just a watered down version of like of the original thing. And so I think like I had that clever opinion. And so that allowed me to be like, I'm not listening to live music at all because we don't have the time to listen to everything. And when you have an opinion like that, it makes it easier to like kind of check things out. And so, but then I watched this Grateful Dead documentary that is on Amazon right now, and it is very good. And then Sylvan Esso with this live album came out. And also I ordered a Nick Cave album from my local record store, Rushmore Records, here in Milwaukee. And Dan threw in a live album as well. And so I kind of like listened to all these three live albums, and I was like, you know what? What was I doing all those years? These live albums are great. It's such a different vibe and energy, and you hear the audience. And I've opened the doors in a way that I haven't before, and it's such a great way to listen to and hear these albums like I never did before. It's rediscovering things that I already knew.
Now that you're a convert, what do you think makes for a good live album experience?
It's really interesting listening to all of these because you kind of like hear the different ways that there are to record live albums. Like the Grateful Dead's live albums are in front of gigantic audiences, but you don't really hear any of that audience. And there are like in the Sylvan Esso With album, you really do hear the audience. And so you hear these like different kind of takes that you can have on one. And like, personally, I like the audience in there. I like when you can hear the crowd interacting with the singer because that is what makes a live thing special, is that the audience feeds the singer, and then the singer is fed by that energy and gives it back to the audience. That is just something that you don't get on a studio album. And that sometimes when I'm in the crowd at a show, I don't really feel like I am a part of the show in a way that I hear it on these recordings. And so I like hearing a bit of that audience in there to kind of like to understand and feel that relationship, that like transfer of energy between the singer and the audience.
Well, we've got some examples that you provided to share, Justin. I'm going to be selfish though, yeah, and share one of mine here. One of my earliest live albums, U2, Under a Blood Red Sky, because it kind of illustrates your point. Here's a listen to the opening of that album. All right, I could just let the whole album play now, honestly, and skip the rest of the show. Justin, I love this one, but this, I, like, this is the my favorite U2 album of all time. The live version killed some studio versions for me. They seem boring by comparison. I don't know. Have you ever had that feeling?
That's such a great example. That is such a great example right there in just playing that tiny clip of, like, you know, there's this moment where I was at a Billie Eilish concert this past summer, and she just held the microphone out to the crowd and she said, "Let it out." You know, and it was like everyone is there pent up with that energy. And then, like, at the beginning of that U2 one, it's like you hear the crowd just being like, they're at this show. They're excited to be there. U2 is on stage, and you just hear that scream. And then Bono gives it back right there. You know, like, he kind of, like, lets it go too. And there's no, you don't get that anywhere else. That is exciting, you know.
We're talking about the joy of listening to live albums or live concert videos. Justin Barney is with us from Radio Milwaukee, music director there. You can join in if you have a favorite you want to share with us at 800-642-1234. Well, let's check out some that you shared on your list. You wrote a piece on this, and the first one you mentioned as a favorite is Sam Cooke at the Harlem Square Club in 1963. Here's a taste of Twistin' the Night Away. Sam Cooke there, Justin. And my first thought on hearing this one is, you know, it's not like studio quality audio. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. It actually really sounds like it might sound if you were there in the club.
For sure. One of the things I love about that is, like, Sam Cooke kind of, like, he had this kind of, he was very put together. You know, he was like a crossover artist, and he appealed to black and white audiences. And then that recording, he's live at the Harlem Square Club. He's in Harlem. It's 1963. All those, like, Twistin' the Night Away, that song is up, like, maybe up, like, up a beat and a half from what it normally is. And so it just has this, like, this new tempo. And he is just, like, you can just hear him kind of, like, lean back and get into it in a way that you, like, that he just didn't do on his studio albums. And you definitely feel like what it is to be at the Harlem Square Club in 1963.
All right, now let's move in another direction. This is one you've mentioned, and it's on your list, a recent album by Sylvan Esso out just last month. Here's a listen to the song Die Young. I was a firecracker baby with something to prove. Contend with the living blues. I couldn't miss it. I never knew. Chain reaction, but you're holding the fuse. I was gonna die young. Now this is a different kind of live album. Justin, tell us about this one.
For sure. Like, first, like, in that, you just hear how Amelia Meath, the lead singer, she just has the crowd in the palm of her hand. And that is how she performs, with this energy, like, she's got you. She has you right where she wants you. And Sylvan Esso, normally, that band met at the Cactus Club, which is a block from my house right now here in Milwaukee. And they're a duo. And Nick Sanborn, he does, like, all the electronic blips and bloops, and she is the lead singer. And for that record, they kind of, like, deconstructed those songs, and they gave them they built in a live band made up of a bunch of people from Wisconsin, and they toured it with they called it With. So it was like normally the duo, they broke it out into a huge band, and then they played it at a couple concerts, and they recorded that. And if you see them, you just see the control that Amelia Meath has. And you can, like, you could just, like, hear her bending those notes and kind of, like, holding you in the palm of her hand like she does there.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Appleton. James, hi.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me on. During the about 90 through 94, I was deep on Dead tour, and you know, nothing like the for the head like good old Dead. But, you know, even though they had all those bootlegs that were going around at the time, I think one of my definitely go-to albums for live album would have to be Without a Net. I think that captures that time frame on tour of the Dead, and you know, you can't beat on that album the song Victim of the Crime. It is by far completely stellar. You gotta love Bobby, and that's all I have to say.
James, thanks so much for that call. And you mentioned the Grateful Dead earlier, Justin, and that's a band that existed, I think, mainly to be live. You don't think of them as a studio band in the first place, really.
For sure. And that was a bit of that sparked this whole thing is on Amazon. There is, I think it's called A Long and Strange Trip, and it's a whole doc about the Dead. And that was kind of like their whole thing was, this is an ephemeral experience that will only be here, and you can only feel it if you're in person. And then at kind of the end of the doc, they talk about how that got changed around, because in living in the moment and those songs, and what makes those concerts great is that they are truly in the moment and they're responding to each other in real time, that they also became the most recorded band of all time, and heads go through and listen obsessively to these live performances that were kind of built to exist and then to leave, to be done with. But, you know, the culture has kind of like grabbed these moments that should float away and have scrutinized them to no end in a joy. And I think that is the joy of it, is that you can take this thing that existed only to exist, and you can live in that moment as they were living in the moment when you hear those Dead albums.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Justin Barney, music director at Radio Milwaukee, about some great live albums and the joy of listening to live albums. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lots of people calling in. Do you have a favorite of your own, a live album or concert video? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Justin Barney from Radio Milwaukee about great live albums and concert videos. You can call in with your favorite at 800-642-1234. Justin, we came back in with Prince there, and we'd already had you booked for this. This weekend, I saw the Prince Estate had put up this 1985 concert on YouTube and elsewhere, fundraising for COVID-19 relief. I watched a good chunk of it over the weekend. Astounding, just amazing to go back and watch a guy at his peak having tons of fun, sell it, like all of his energy on the table there. Do you like to get out and see videos as well as the live albums?
Well, in doing this, I think that one of the things that kind of like seeing everybody do the stream, it kind of made me miss the audience. So like I have definitely like been participating in some of the streams, but the seeing people do live streams made me realize how important I am as an audience member. You know, I was flattered with myself, honestly. Rob, have you ever seen Prince? Did you see him live?
I never saw him in concert. You know, I listened back in the day. I had Purple Rain and other albums. I never saw a show. And every time I watched Prince on a, you know, live video, I was like, why? Why yeah. did I not go see him live?
But I think that that is part of the greatness of these things, is like, I never saw Prince either, but you can see him in that video and you can listen to him here, and you can like kind of, you know, listening to them live is a bit of their personality. Prince yeah. was very much like Amelia Meath here, where it's like their body is a part of the show, and the kind of like that attitude that they have the whole time is something that is kind of hard to get on tape. But when you get them in front of an audience, that performance aspect is something that like we'll never get to see with Prince because we never saw him, but you can definitely hear it in these live albums and see it on those videos.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Antioch. Steve, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Steve?
Oh, well, I wanted to tell you, I got some both on you guys. I have seen Prince live.
Ah!
Yeah, that was one of the most fantastic things I've ever seen. But the
Steve.
Album I wanted to bring up was How the West Was Won by Led Zeppelin.
Ooh. Zeppelin was known for great live shows and albums. Yeah, tell us about that one, Steve.
My library is closed, and I have had this album for the last 2.5 months, and it is just fantastic. It's from L.A. Forum and L.A. Coliseum, and it has all of the classic songs live.
Awesome. Steve, thank you so much. Yeah, Zeppelin, I know you're serious Zeppelin fans. Love the live shows, Justin.
Yeah, and it's like Zeppelin is one of those bands where, sometimes I've seen bands, like I saw The Who once, like kind of on a whim, and like I like The Who just as much as anybody else, and I would imagine Zeppelin's kind of the same thing, where you're listening to the live show, and the live show it's a culmination of an entire career, and so with Zeppelin, I just can't believe it's probably just hit after hit after hit. So it's just like it's like a greatest hits album and a live experience at the same time.
Thanks a lot, Steve. We'll go to Adam now in Mineral Point. Adam, hi.
Hi.
Are you there, Adam?
Yeah, this is Adam.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would just like to bring up Peter Frampton live, 1975. Just a wonderful, wonderful live album. And that would have been probably the first live album that I remember listening to. And my dad had that record and on vinyl, of course, and just a great album.
Adam, thanks a lot. And that's one, you know, Do You Feel Like We Do? That's one where you can definitely hear the audience going nuts at the solos and all the bits of it. It's a very long song. It's a nice late night classic rock radio song to hear, keep you entertained while you're driving for a while. That is the biggest Peter Frampton album, that live one, I think, Justin.
Yeah, Peter Frampton Comes Alive is one of the great albums that, like, Peter Frampton, like, was, you know, wasn't exactly famous when he released that, but that is the album that like blew him into stardom. Was a live, usually you release a live album when you have a body of work and then you kind of release that. And Peter Frampton, it was one of those rare things where the live album was way bigger than all the studio albums, just like a total anomaly, which is super cool to see.
Thanks for bringing that one up, Adam. We're talking about great live albums to listen to get that feel of the live show, even if you can't go right about now. Justin Barney with us from Radio Milwaukee. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us now in Appleton. Dan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dan?
Courtney Barnett. It's a YouTube video. It's just called Live in Melbourne. And this gal, it covers a great range of her work. It's about an hour and 20 minutes, and she even does a cover of Cannonball.
Wow. Okay. I only know studio work by Courtney Barnett, Justin.
Yeah. Courtney Barnett is one of the great songwriters that, you know, is currently releasing music. And I talked to Courtney Barnett once. I interviewed her. She called me from Australia. And she's kind of like in her music, she's kind of like famously shy. And in talking to her, she barely said a word. And I was like, this, that is. And so seeing the live experience is like, I can imagine it is getting a bit of flavor of her personality and also getting that like great songwriting and, you know, just kind of seeing how she reacts. She's also a left-handed guitar player, which is, you know, must be fun to see if you're watching that video.
Thanks a lot for the call. Patrick is with us now in Green Bay. Patrick, hi.
Hi, thank you. I love talking about music, and I have two things briefly to mention. And this is where I'm going to probably be bringing in the concert video piece of this. For me, the Talking Heads Stop Making Sense. And
oh, yeah.
Whether it's the record, the you know, just listening to the concert, but the concert video is is far and away my favorite to watch, and it's directed by Jonathan Demme before he was doing movies. It what I appreciate so much about it is that I believe before a lot of kind of editing techniques came where with constantly moving the camera all the time, that is, drives me crazy. And when you watch Stop Making Sense, that's not you. The camera stays still. Stays still for sometimes for very long shots.
Patrick, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And good news, that one was on Justin's list, I think. Let's give a listen to a little bit Stop Making Sense and Burning Down the House. So, yeah, talk about this one, Justin.
Yeah, Stop Making Sense is the pinnacle. It is the ideal of what every show sets out to be. The thing that I like most about Stop Making Sense is the motion of the show. It starts off with Psycho Killer, and it's just David Byrne on guitar, and then with each song they add an element, and they add it, like they add a bass player, and then the drums come in, and then the background singers, and the whole thing has this kind of like building momentum towards it that is truly unparalleled in anything else.
Thanks a lot for that call and all your calls. Justin, no time to play anymore, though. I think we're gonna go out with a little bit of Grateful Dead. Does it make you hungry to go out and see a real live show as soon as we're able to do that?
Yes, of course it does. And I did want to say that one thing that I did was make a playlist of all of my favorite live things. And with the audience clapping out of every song and into, it's like a perfect concert that you made just for yourself. And I encourage everybody to do that.
Justin, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Rob. This is great.
But talking to Justin Barney, music director for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee, he talked with us about the appeal of the live album and shared some of his favorites. We'll get a link up at WPR.org/Central Time to his blog, where I think he's got that playlist he just mentioned. And you can keep sharing your favorite live concert albums and videos over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go out with one more live track of the Grateful Dead playing here in 1972. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a rare inflammatory disease is being reported in a small number of children around the world, and it's possibly related to COVID-19. We'll talk to a Wisconsin pediatrician about the illness and what we still don't know about it. Now, this past weekend was the first since the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's stay-at-home order. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says people flocked to Lake Geneva on Saturday to take advantage of nice weather and visit restaurants, shop, and get out. Residents of Illinois also reportedly headed to the city as their state remains shut down for a couple more weeks. With no statewide rules in place to guard against COVID-19, Wisconsin businesses can largely decide for themselves whether and how to reopen. Some areas, like Milwaukee and Dane counties, quickly put their own safeguards in place. While Governor Evers still favors a statewide approach to battling the virus, state Republicans say it's not necessary and that businesses and local governments can be trusted to reopen safely. We talked to Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes on Thursday. Right now, Van Wongard joins us. He's a Republican state senator and majority caucus chair from Wisconsin's 21st district. That includes parts of Racine and Kenosha counties. Senator Wongard, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's great being out with you, Rob. It's a great day to be out and about and alive.
And we have a reliable source is telling us that this is your 47th wedding anniversary today. If so, congratulations.
Uh-oh, cat's out of the bag. That's correct. 47 years married, and then I dated my wife for 5 years, too. So it's actually 52, but 47 is a pretty good goal anyway.
Not too bad. Well, thanks for taking time on that important day. Well, let's get to the topic at hand. What do you see now? What is your reaction to that statewide change now from the Supreme Court last week and the end of Safer at Home?
Well, honestly, you know, when this first started and they first put the 2-week quarantine in place for everybody, that really kind of made sense, even though it really didn't fit with our ability to, for our freedoms, just locking everybody down and closing businesses. But I could at least understand that. Then when it continued to be evolving 2 weeks, and then in the middle of the next 2 weeks, they sent it into the middle of May, that made no sense. So I think what the court did is the court looked at what actually was brought forward by DHS, and they rightly found that an unelected individual should not have more authority to tell people that they could be locked in their homes and close their business indefinitely, even more so than what the legislature or the governor has the authority to do. So I think that was definitely the right call. And I think that just locking people up in their own environment doesn't allow for herding to occur, which we know is something that continues to work against these viruses, to kill these viruses. And so by locking everybody up, you just create the potential for less immunity to the virus itself. So I think we're on the right track.
You're saying the buildup of herd immunity, is that what you're referring to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if you talk to a lot of the physicians, and I've talked to our infectious disease expert in Racine County, and an individual that did travel medicine for decades, a doctor that my wife worked with for about 15 years, and he said, this is exactly right that we should be doing herd immunity. We should be protecting the vulnerable. Don't lock everybody up and close businesses. That's going to become worse than the virus itself.
The idea of herd immunity is, as I understand it, a pretty long time off. The concern in the meantime was having too many cases happening at once, putting our resources at risk, especially potentially in rural Wisconsin. The argument has been that safer at home is helping us and helped us avoid that. Do you agree with that, that at least initially that did it? And if so, why is now the right time to stop that?
Sure. Maybe in the first 2 weeks that made sense. This is the problem I have. The data that they used to begin with was so far off and so inaccurate that they were doing models. They were projecting 2.2 million people dying in the next 10 days. Well, we know that didn't happen. And then it went down to 1.1, then down to 600,000, then down to 200,000. You know, we don't want to lose any life if we don't have to. But if you look at all the other death rates that are normally there, like from heart attack, we generally have about 675,000 deaths from heart attacks every year. And from other types of things like cancer, those are in the 300,000-400,000 strokes. Look at the death rates across the country for how they are recording these COVID deaths, and you'll find that they've all dropped 25-30%, even more, because they're just coding them as presumably having been COVID-19 deaths. So do we really know what the accurate data is? If you put inaccurate information, and that's what you're getting out.
I want a lot of the public health experts I've talked to, though, say we're undercounting COVID-19 because a lot of them weren't tested initially and thus not coded.
No, I think that maybe from the testing standpoint, and remember earlier in this early process when they were doing testing, the testing wasn't that effective either. It was like 60% accurate or 50% accurate because they didn't know what they were testing for, so they didn't have a lot of those tests available. Tests have gotten better. We're testing a lot more now. So I think we're going to see there's a lot more asymptomatic people that already have this, that have had this. But, you know, I think when you look at this from the standpoint of locking people up, we should be looking at making sure that people are vulnerable, are protected. And, you know, it's about making good choices, and it's about washing your hands and not breathing on people or coughing on people. And, you know, I mean, these are just things that are common sense that, quite honestly, we can't take and legislate. And I was going to say, if you go to the Wisconsin Health Association website, you can see what the occupancy rate is in our hospitals every day, and it's in real time. And you look at the number of people that we have in ICU, as an example, in ICU beds from COVID-19, and it's about 110, I think, today, something like that. So we're going to lock down 8 million people because we have 100 people or 110 people in ICU. And we have all these additional resources that are available. It hasn't overwhelmed our system. So I think that at what point does the virus become, or the cure to the virus become worse than the virus? And I think that's where we're at right now. We've got to make that decision. We can't kill all our businesses. We just can't.
We're talking to Republican State Senator Van Wongard from Racine and Kenosha counties, talking about the state's reaction to the COVID-19 outbreak and the end of safer at home orders. So now we have local and county governments, some of them putting safer at home orders of their own into effect, some not, some doing it briefly and then withdrawing it over legal concerns. What do you think of that that approach? Some locals being able to do that, others not?
Well, I think that we should have, it should be regionalized and it should be local considering what the circumstances are in your local area. But just locking it down to lock it down, that doesn't make any sense to me. As an example, City of Racine is, they've got everything closed up tight still. And they're going to lose a lot of businesses that can't, aren't going to be able to go through this. Businesses get it. They know that if they can only see three people coming in the door, they're going to figure out ways to do their business. You know, taking that right away from a business owner is just absolutely wrong. And taking it away from people that do have a brain on their head and are going to go out there and exercise good common sense. I mean, this is America. This isn't Russia. It isn't Germany. This is America. We should be able to make those decisions, I think, for ourselves. And if you look at it as an example, the City of Racine, their health people just locked it down the same as the thing that we just was taken out by the Supreme Court ruled to be unenforceable. That's basically what the City of Racine has enacted locally. And then you have the Central Racine County Health Department, which is everything else but the City of Racine. All of those municipalities, they have their own health department, and they put guidelines out, new recommendations. These are guidelines. They're not going to have the police out making arrests if you're 5 feet away from somebody instead of six. But they came out with something that were some really good guidelines that came out through Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. So they agreed with those, and I think these are really common sense, and you can find that on their website. Can't see where it is. Oh, here it is. www.crchd.com/COVID-19. And that'll give you Caledonia's or the Central Racine County guidelines they have. These are common sense. So I think it's about just making good choices, making common sense, educating people what they should do. But it doesn't make sense. One of my colleagues quickly, when we had one of our conference calls, said they had one COVID death in his district. And in that same week, they had four suicides directly tied to COVID-19. People that lost their jobs or their businesses were going down, they committed suicide. So what's worse? Is it worse to have people dying because of those kinds of issues? Or is it worse to go to work and have a business and use a little common sense with how you're making your livelihood and feeding your family? I think that's what America's all about.
As we wrap up, I want to look at efforts to help get businesses back on track. Governor Evers announced a $75 million initiative aimed at grants for local businesses to help them improve safety measures. This is funded by some of the federal economic recovery package passed. What do you think of this plan? They're calling it the We're All In initiative.
Well, you know, this is the deal. Just throwing money at it is not necessarily what we need to do either. As far as the governor's administration is concerned, he has not been very forthcoming with meeting with the legislature, discussing these issues, and I don't care what he says on his press conferences. The day before the Supreme Court ruling came down, our leadership talked to the governor and wanted to sit down and start talking before that decision came out. And his response was, well, we just have to wait and see what happens. Instead of sitting down and starting to talk about it and have a conversation, that's the only way we're going to get things done through consensus. Instead of, as an example, he withdrew his scope statement and his response was, well, we're never going to be able to do anything anyway. Well, that tells me that that man does not, and his administration does not want to sit down and have a conversation. And I'm telling you, it's very frustrating. And if you ask legislators on both sides of the aisle, I'll sit down and talk with people about things. And there's many of our colleagues that want to sit down and have a conversation, but he doesn't want to do that. So all this rhetoric with what he puts out there is a big sham, and he creates the chaos. And I love the way he likes to throw that word out there, but it's really challenging because this should not be a political football. We're talking about, you know, people's livelihoods. And I talked to some young people today that were having suicidal thoughts because of school issues and not being able to complete them. I want to sit down and have a conversation about what we're going to do with schools. There's so much pressure that these kids are going through. Those are the kinds of discussions we should be having. We shouldn't be just arguing about, well, I don't want to sit down and they're not going to talk to me about this.
Well, just to clarify, your Republican colleague, Senator Steve Nossett, asked the Evers administration to withdraw that scope statement.
He sure did, because the scope statement that he put in there was basically the same safer at home that the court just found to be unconstitutional. So why would we even entertain that, given that it's not lawfully able to be enforced to begin with? Just locking people down is not going to work. We're not going to give an unelected person the ability to go and shut the entire state down and tell 8 million people you got to stay home. That's not going to happen. We need to sit down and have a conversation. And, you know, his scope statement, if you look at the statement, it basically parallels what he put out, what the court found was not enforceable or not operable. And there's also another court case pending with the Supreme Court that deals with the constitutionality of keeping people home. And I think I'm hoping that that result's going to come out pretty quick, and I think we will prevail. I think the people that brought the suit are going to prevail with that, because you can't just tell people you're going to stay home. You know, back in the old days when I was a kid, and if you had German measles or you had mumps, they quarantined the house you lived in or quarantined you to a room in the house because you had the infectious disease. They didn't tell everybody else in the city, gee, Van's got the measles, so everybody else stay home so you don't get it. That makes no sense. And that's
Senator Wongard, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate being on your show.
That's Van Wongard, Republican State Senator and Majority Caucus Chair for Wisconsin's 21st District in southeastern Wisconsin. We talked to him today about the state's approach to reopening Wisconsin's economy. We heard from Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes on Thursday. Up next, there's a small number of cases of a rare inflammatory disease tied to COVID-19 that's affecting children. We'll learn more about the illness and what we're trying to figure out. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from two Wisconsin lawmakers about their new bipartisan bill that would set guidelines for holding elections during a state of emergency. First, the CDC issued an alert to doctors about a rare inflammatory disease impacting children and its connection to COVID-19. The condition is called multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC. Symptoms include fever and a rash, as well as stomach issues, sluggishness, and eye irritation. There are cases of the rare illness across the U.S. and abroad, with New York State having the highest number. So far, none confirmed here in Wisconsin. The illness has been likened to another rare childhood inflammatory condition known as Kawasaki disease, doctors saying, though, that there are symptoms that make it different. Dr. Dipesh Navzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navzaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, this is emerging just over the last week or two. What's the latest that we know about this unusual condition?
Well, this condition has kind of appeared, as you say, in the last couple of weeks in terms of being recognized as something that's happening to children. It's a inflammatory illness, meaning that there's elements of inflammation in different organ systems, different parts of the body. And in most, although not quite all cases, it seems to be associated with COVID infection in children. The initial reports have sounded very much like another condition that you mentioned called Kawasaki disease that we've known about for decades. Kawasaki disease, unfortunately, despite the fact that it's well known to us, we have yet to figure out what's causing it. There's no specific organism that's ever been identified. So when these reports came out, we wondered, is this a variant in Kawasaki disease? Is it something that's related to Kawasaki in some form? We do know that this does seem to be somewhat more severe in the children who do get it. But again, I want to emphasize, it's a very, very tiny number of children who are getting it. So it's significant, but it's not necessarily as much of a concern as it is than, say, COVID-19 is in general for vulnerable adults.
Right. And that's an important point, that this isn't something that people should worry too much about. What are we looking at next when it comes to what this condition is and how it relates to COVID-19?
Yeah, so what we do know is that some children are developing these symptoms, and the key thing that makes it more severe is that they're often having something we call shock, which is basically where the entire body's system is responding with drops in blood pressure, these kind of cascades of immunological reactions that just cause their heart and lungs and kidneys and so on to be affected, and they do need hospitalization and care. And that seems to be affecting them more than anything. So far, it seems that they are recovering in the cases that have occurred. So it's not exactly, and the same is true of Kawasaki disease, that most of the time children do improve with the treatments that are available. But again, we don't know precisely what the cause is, and not every child that has this new MISC entity has been found to have had COVID, and we're not sure if that's because COVID is not 100% the cause, or is it that the testing is not necessarily showing us COVID is present when it really is.
Now, one big question in our public health response to COVID-19 has been, you know, when can kids go back to school? And one hope was that since this is something that seems to affect older people, adults more than kids, it'd be safer to send them back to school sooner. Does this concern change the equation there much at all?
I'm not sure that it does, because even before this concern, the purpose behind keeping children out of early childhood settings, out of school, et cetera, is that even if they're not as dramatically affected as adults, children can have a higher likelihood of potentially transmitting infection throughout the community. Younger children in particular are not necessarily as good about, you know, washing their hands or, you know, being careful how they sneeze or cough or things like that. So it was meant to kind of really reduce the amount of spread throughout the community to some extent. Given that we're looking at last numbers I saw, and these are varying every day, in the United States of this MISC, we're only seeing somewhere over 200 cases total, which is really not a very large number. Now, it's awful for the families and the kids who are getting it. I don't want to downplay that. But to put this into perspective, every year in the United States, we see somewhere between 100 and 200 pediatric deaths due to influenza, right? This influenza virus, which we do have a vaccine for and so on. And over 4,000 children die every year from motor vehicle conditions, right? Just to kind of try to put the numbers on that. So would I say that something that we aren't 100% sure of what the cause is in something that in a pandemic that's so widespread, should this change school reopening decisions? I don't know that I would go there yet unless we have better data on which to base that.
I want to take our last couple of minutes to talk to you about something I know you are very concerned with, education for early childhood, and now kids aren't able to go to the daycare centers or elementary schools at this time. Do you have some thoughts for parents out there to help their kids learn, or teachers try to help those kids remotely?
So, yes, I think this is a great challenge for so many families to try to figure out how to work through all this. What I'm going to say is that, first of all, whatever you're doing with your children right now, you know, we're all trying to do the best we can. And I say this as a parent of two teenagers who are also cooped up at home. We're all trying the best we can. Not everything has to be about assignments and factual learning and so on. And I think taking the opportunities to do what you can with the outdoors, to look at things together online, to even talk about the news, not in a obsessing about every new little thing about COVID that's going on, but what is out there, are great ways to teach your children to be curious about the world and how to ask good questions. A lot of the things, even about COVID, are great opportunities to say, how do you question what's out there? And how do you ask good questions about what's being presented and what the motives are and what kind of care people put into the reporting of those things? So I think those are all opportunities that parents can take to really help teach their children without necessarily worrying so much about formal education, because I think this is a challenge for everyone.
And briefly, I imagine it's a good time to read to kids just for fun, too.
I think it's an excellent time to be reading together. And whether it's to kids, to each other, I think even adults should probably spend some time reading aloud to each other. It can be wonderful to hear each other's voices in a different cadence and style than we might typically use.
Well, it's good to hear your voice remotely, Dr. Nafsaria. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
That's Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and President of the Wisconsin Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He joins us today to talk about a very rare inflammatory disease possibly tied to COVID-19. It's been reported in a small number of children across the globe. He joined us to help put that disease and the numbers in perspective. Also joined us with some advice on how to help kids learn during Safer at Home or post Safer at Home as schools are closed. If you have a favorite thing you've been reading to your kids, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. For some reason, earlier today, a random topic came up, the game called Pogs.
I'm really sorry. I kind of traded your soul to the guy at the comic book store. But look, I got some cool Pogs. Elf Pogs. Remember Elf? He's back in Pog form.
Milhouse from The Simpsons there. Now, I never played Pogs, so they're not part of my nostalgia, but Central Time producer Tim Peterson did. Hey, Tim.
Hey there, Rob.
Now, some people just collected Pogs, but there was a game, and you actually played. Do I have that right?
I did play from time to time. Now, I don't think I played, like, maybe the official rules. If you bought, like, the starter pack Pog game, I think there's a game that's come back up in, like, app form or, you know, video game form. You know, I remember it's very simply, you know, stacks of Pogs on a little table on a set. In fact, I had something that resembled a circular saw that was like painted red with a yin yang on it because, you know, yin yangs in the 90s, it was a big thing. Uh-huh. And you'd use slammers to kind of just like shove the stack of Pogs down and see if you could get them to flip.
All right. And did you have any cherished Pogs in your collection?
I had a slammer that you kind of messed up the Pogs with that closely resembled an Oreo. Don't know where it is at the time, but we were close then.
All right. Well, now I want some Oreos. Tim, thanks a lot.
Anytime, Rob.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.